Wait a minute. Is it just me who has never heard of this woman?
She, since the 1970s, has lived in a mental health institution.
She started experiencing hallucinations at the age of 10.
Yeah, I think she jumped off of her apartment balcony in New York.
She burned 2,000 of her paintings by the river, and she said to herself, I will paint much better than this.
She created this thing in her house, which she called the Church of Self-Obliteration, and performed the first gay marriage ceremony.
She famously wrote Richard Nixon an open letter offering to have sex with him if he would stop the Vietnam War.
We also have to remember, she was born in 1929. So this is pre-World War II. She spent decades producing without recognition, without fame, without money.
And I just think about how ludicrous that number is. 8,700 works of art.
She's so prolific.
The world needs to know more about this human who is actually still alive.
Drum roll, please. Welcome back to the Shit You Don't Learn in School podcast. This is Calvin Rosser.
And this is Yayoi Kusama.
What?
Just kidding. This is Steph Smith. And today we are sharing with you a wonderful female artist, Yayoi Kusama, who is badass.
Okay. Nice introduction. So, Steph, why don't we start with your Zoom background? What is that?
It is an infinity mirror room, which people have probably seen before, because if they've ever been to Japan's Borderless exhibit, which went wild on social media, and there's been many other exhibits like it, these infinity rooms were actually concepted way back in the 1960s, around 1965, by this woman, Yayoi Kusama, which is crazy because they feel like a new relevant thing, but that's 50, 60 years ago.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
And they're super cool. You basically feel like you are in this room and it never ends. That's why it's called a infinity room.
Yeah, I guess it's hard to tell from the picture itself, but actually how we discovered Yayoi was I was in the Guggenheim Museum, which is in Bilbao, Spain. That's at the northern part of Spain in Basque Country. I was finishing up a trip in France and Spain, going to the airport and stopped by a museum. And actually, I really genuinely am not a big fan of museums in that I'm kind of bored and I walk around aimlessly, even when I'm in some of the best ones. And I'm like, man, there should be someone else who appreciates this art a bit more. But Yayoi's work was in this Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, and they had a full collection of her work from 1945 to the present day, which I didn't pay that much attention to until I entered her Infinity Mirror Room, which was, I think, just a spinoff of whatever you have in your background. But I spent 45 seconds in the room. It was like a 10 by 10. There was one other person in there. And I was like, man, I want to spend 30 minutes in here and see if I can explore the trenches of my mind or the cosmos or just existence itself. It was actually kind of like a spiritual experience or the beginning of one to go into this physical exhibit. And it really energized me to check out more of her work at the museum, which we'll talk about more in terms of what she actually produces. But I thought it was a really cool in-person experience. And I'd say I'm hard to impress with art, even the best art. And it's not because I'm sophisticated. It's because I'm actually the opposite.
It's because we're not. I know. Yeah. Most museums I go into, I am like, I should enjoy this more. And so I do think it's really refreshing when you have the opposite experience, when you're pleasantly surprised. And you came home and I was preparing for a podcast appearance. And someone had asked me as prep, what are some interesting things that you've seen recently? And I asked you, and you're like, well, there's this 94-year-old woman who has this art exhibit in the Guggenheim. And I was like, yeah. But then as you told me more, I was like, wait a minute. She's 94, and we'll get into more of her life, but she lives out of a mental facility because she's really struggled with mental illness, and she continues to create art and has for decades. And she's actually insanely successful, and her art sells for millions. And I was like, wait a minute. Is it just me who has never heard of this woman, or what's going on here? And I think actually a lot of people have probably not heard of Yayoi. And so that's why we wanted to do this episode, right? It just felt like when I heard about her, I was like, I need to hear more about this person. I need to learn more. And then as I did that, I was like, the world needs to know more about this human who is actually still alive.
I had a similar experience. Obviously, I experienced the in-person art first, but then when I looked her up, the line that really did catch me was that she, since the 1970s, has lived in a mental health institution, I think in Tokyo. And I don't think she leaves all that often, except she goes to her studio to create art every day. And that was amazing. And I wanted to learn more. And then I think the next step that we did was we actually watched a movie. It's like a little documentary about her life. I believe it's called Kusama Infinity. It's on Amazon Prime. And that was just fascinating. That actually, you know, showed video of her early life and went through all of her work. And I think that sent us further down the rabbit hole. And we were both just really impressed and want to share some of what we learned here today.
I think that documentary was really well done. And I would definitely recommend if people want to watch it. Before we get into her life, I thought I'd just give you a sense of the kind of work that she's created, which is very, very far reaching. So she creates these massive pumpkin sculptures that are in different parts of the world. And I think these are the pieces of art that now sell for the most. I think one of them sold for $8 million relatively recently. She also is known for her polka dots. So she has all these exhibits with polka dots. And I think that has to do with a story from way back when she was by the river where she grew up and she saw all these stones and these dots kind of, in a way, haunt her. And she's created all types of crazy things. Like behind me, there's these neon also dots and balls. And I don't know. She's also created soft sculpture and just a very interesting artist that has continuously reinvented herself. Cal, what's your favorite?
It's hard to know the favorite. I'm thinking back to the experience in the actual museum, and they actually had everything. They had the pumpkins, they had the like soft sculptures, which she does almost like furniture like pieces that have some sort of phallic looking structures like protruding from them. Mm-hmm. And then she had this one piece on death that I was looking at, and I'm like, I don't know if I should look at this for too long. This is spooky. I really like the in-person exhibits. I do like the pumpkins a lot. Obviously her trademark though is just polka dots in general. Like if you Google her name, mm-hmm. like she honestly looks like a character that you want to know more about. I mean, she has such a funky vibe. If you're looking to change up your wardrobe or wondering if you're being too out there with your clothing, just look up Yao Yayoi, and I think that will inspire you to go further in the direction of expressing yourself in a certain way. And she definitely uses like polka dots, I think, in most of everything, and that seems to be like the iconic thing for her.
Yeah. I think after going down the rabbit hole of her and her life, I think she might be the artist that I actually want to own a piece from the most, because you can just tell through both the art, certainly through the documentary, that her art is a reflection of her own mental perception of the world, her mental issues throughout her life. And she even has been quoted as saying, "If it were not for art, I would have killed myself a long time ago." So yeah, you can really see her, like her as a person, in her art.
Well, if you want to own one of her pieces, we're gonna have to start doing this podcast a lot more regularly.
Yeah, we might need a couple sponsors. Why don't we talk about her life? It's been 94 years of Yayoi Kusama on this earth. And I guess where it all started was, she's Japanese. She grew up in a place called Matsumoto, Japan. She grew up on a farm. She loved art from a young age. But interestingly, her family was not very supportive at all of her artistic endeavors.
Yeah, I think this is in the documentary about her life, but there was some sort of thing where she's so prolific because she works really quickly. And she works really quickly because I think when she was a teenager, her mom didn't want her to do art. And she basically mm-hmm. had a finite period of time where she had some solitude, and she was like doing art really quickly. And she had to finish it like before her mom got there. And I can't remember the exact details, but there was some sort of trauma that seemed to exist like through today. So that yeah. was something I thought was like really interesting, in that she didn't go and figure that out via therapy, or, you know, she struggles with mental health kind of on a deep fundamental level, but she actually used that to infuse into her work process, which is still very hurried, as if someone is about to come and stop her from doing her work.
Yeah. I mean, we've spoken about her mental health already, but she had a very interesting childhood. I mean, her mother would send her as a young child to spy on her father as he had affairs. And then that influenced her relationship with sex and sexuality. She's been quoted as saying, "I don't like sex. I had an obsession with sex, When I was a kid, my father had lovers and I experienced seeing him. My mother sent me to spy on him. I didn't want to have sex with anyone for years. You can see, as you said, some of that coming through in her artwork and being represented in that way. She also was known quite early on for these infinity nets. And I think that was also a representation of what she calls self-obliteration. Like she really is using art to like almost wade away the thoughts that she cannot suppress. And she even said that she started experiencing hallucinations at the age of 10. And again, art was a way of her over time expressing that, like moving through that. But also when she was a kid, her family was not happy about that art. So it was like this tug and pull. And even the kinds of art that she was creating didn't seem to be accepted in Japan either.
We also have to remember she was born in 1929. So this is pre-World War II. Like this is a long time ago. If you think about the arc of the time period through which she's lived, both from the development of Japan, but the broader world around Japan as well. And so I think, yeah, during her early years, it would have been extremely unusual, especially for a female to go pursue something like art back in the 1930s, 1940s. And I think she started creating art in her teenage years and then eventually ended up moving to New York in her early 30s after a recommendation from Georgia O'Keeffe.
Early 20s, I think. And even before that, by the way, just because her relationship with conflict and war came through later in her life, but she did when she was 13, actually, she was sent to do military work during World War II. And so she definitely lived through not just like a personal family set of tough times, but like to your point, this was like a very tough era for the world.
Yeah. And at some point, like her call to do art, she just kept going, which that alone is impressive to overcome those barriers. Like today, people are like, I'm going to write 10 blog posts and they get half a blog post in and they can't do it despite nothing stopping them. I mean, she really overcame some like tremendous things. And then to take that to the next level, actually from, I think it was from encouragement from Georgia O'Keeffe, another artist. She was like, hey, you need to put yourself in the action, the heart of things, like in New York. And so Yayoi actually left Japan and went to New York in her 20s, I guess.
Let me pause there because I think in the movie, they feature her sending a letter to Georgia O'Keeffe, who was a well-known artist at the time. And I just thought, wow, like that's also so ballsy. Like she was just this young woman from Japan. Her family and others around her weren't very supportive of her work. And she just thought, I'm just going to send a letter to a super well-known artist in America. And I can't remember what she asked for, but like Georgia O'Keeffe responded. And she, I think, helped maybe set her up with a different studio or something in America. I can't remember exactly what happened, but I just thought, that stuff doesn't happen enough today where someone just like completely unknown just shoots their shot and reaches out to someone at the absolute top of their game.
Yeah. I mean, it's remarkable in the fact that she both reached out and then Georgia O'Keeffe actually responded to her, just a young female artist in Japan who she didn't know. I have one quote, I think from the letter, but I think Kusama said, I'm only on the first step on the long and difficult life of being a painter. Will you kindly show me the way? And so she really put out like a call to help to Georgia O'Keeffe. And that's pretty cool because you think, oh, if she never moved to America, the rest of the story might not have happened.
Yeah. And another thing where I was just like, man, this woman is so ballsy, especially for her time. When she moved to America, she actually moved to Seattle first for a year and then New York. But as she was leaving Japan, she grew up in this relatively small town or city in Japan. And she had created a lot of work by that point. She had around 2,000 paintings. And what she did was she went and she burned 2,000 of her paintings by the river. And she said to herself, I will paint much better than this. And I was like, oh my God. Like I was just, when you hear of the legends, you know, in whatever space, like athletics, artistry, science, etc., and you just, it's like this level of conviction of just, I will do better. I will be the best. And you just hear someone at such a young age who had not been validated at all by that point to just be like, this is not the best that I will be. And to actually like, as people say, burn the boats in this case, it's like literally burn the paintings. I just thought that was so badass. To your point about like, we write blog posts and we feel the need to tell the whole world. Like she had no one to tell at that point. This wasn't an act of, hey, everyone, look at me, I'm burning my work. It was truly like a self-inflicted, I must do better.
Yeah, it was like an act of self-destruction. What's funny, if you look at the story in hindsight, those paintings probably would have been worth,
been worth so much.
Hundreds of millions of dollars, her early ones. But then the other thing is, you know, it's a bold act what she did. It's like an act of conviction, and we hear these stories. But like, how many people did stuff like that and they ended up just being delusional? They believed in themselves when they shouldn't have.
Yeah.
And so I just want to point out, like, we like to put these people on pedestals, but it's, we're seeing the story in hindsight. And I don't know, I guess that worked for her, but I don't know if I would replicate, like, just burn all the notebooks. I'm going to do better writing in the future. You know what I mean? It's just a part of her story.
Another part of her story was, this feeling of not fitting into Japanese society. I have a quote from her saying that it was too small, too servile, too feudalistic, and too scornful of women. So she moved again when she was in her 20s in 1957 to the United States and started creating there. And the documentary does a great job of showing just how difficult it was for her at the time, whether it was finding studio space, having to convince people to fund that studio space, getting into exhibits, not fitting in, because at that time there were levels of sexism and racism to which she didn't benefit from either, being a young Japanese woman in the art industry. And I think one other thing that really struck me was that even as she was coming up with pretty novel concepts like her soft sculptures, like the infinity mirror rooms, it seems like there were a ton of artists, and obviously this exists, you know, in many other scenarios, but there were a ton of artists that seemed to be copying her work, who were much more well-known, happened to be already established in the industry. And I think that really got to her. And I think it would get to me too, if, you know, there were examples where she would create soft sculptures, and then all of a sudden someone who had never even played with soft sculpture before had their next exhibit. And then there was even a story of Andy Warhol, where apparently she created this exhibit where she had a boat, and then she had this interesting idea of taking a picture of the boat sculpture and then printing that picture all around, like around the entire exhibit wall. And then there was a case where very shortly after that, Andy Warhol did that with, I think, a cow or something. But the idea was, she was really creative for her time, like coming up with things that people hadn't seen before. And whether or not you think some of these artists were directly copying her, I think it's interesting to see how difficult that was for her. It seems like some of these scenarios where she was just trying so, so, so hard and not being rewarded for the things she thought she should be rewarded for really sent her into a depression. And I think she even tried to commit suicide at one point.
Yeah, I think she like jumped off of her apartment balcony in New York, but it was directly after these imitations. She was a part of the scene of Jackson Pollock, Andy Warhol, like all these people who are extremely well known today, who were these up and coming artists in the late 50s and the 60s. And she was like very much a part of that scene, but getting none of the credit, like none of the invitations. She definitely found some creative ways to find her way in, but it was amazing that she like persisted through that. But clearly it took a toll to the point where she went back to Japan at some point.
Yeah. And on the note of her like not really being accepted in ways into the community, I feel like one of the really great examples of that was she created this thing called the Narcissist Garden. And it was this outdoor exhibit in Italy, I think. And it had all of these spherical balls as part of the exhibit. And basically what she tried to do is she tried to start selling pieces of the exhibit for $2 a piece. And the people who were running this Venice Biennale just stopped her from doing it. And that exhibit was not just a promotion of herself, but also commentary. I feel like a lot of her work was commentary on things that were happening, whether it was around the world or her own life. And in this case, it was commentary on kind of like the commoditization of art, but they just like wouldn't let her do that, which I thought was interesting. I feel like as she was trying to be revolutionary and interesting and different, the art world, they weren't there for that.
Or at least she didn't get the recognition she probably deserved for, I don't know, how forward thinking she was. I think one of the examples we wanted to talk about, things that like really impressed us about Yayoi and like why we wanted to talk to her. And one of the ones that was covered in the documentary was in 1968, she created this thing in her house, which she called the Church of Self-Obliteration, and she called herself the High Princess of Polka Dots. And then she actually performed, I'm assuming it wasn't legal, but what she calls the first gay marriage ceremony mm-hmm. in America. So she married two guys, and she, instead of a Bible, she used a New York City telephone book. And then her wedding, her gift was a two-person bridal gown. And basically she like created a commentary on the fact that like people of the same sex were not allowed to get married in America. She performed the ceremony, she made it into an art piece. And then she said this quote I found, which is, "The purpose of this marriage is to bring out into the open what has hitherto been concealed. Love can now be free, but to make it completely free, it must be liberated from all sexual frustrations imposed by society. Homosexuality is a normal physical and psychological reaction, neither to be extolled or decreed." Maybe people today would quibble with like the language she used, but I mean, she is so forward thinking and acting and using her art to promote something that I think today is a more consensus belief of what should exist, like people to be able to do what they want. And the thing that I found, I guess, most impressive about this is, as you mentioned, she did not like sex herself. Like, I think she just decided not to have sex. So I guess it's related to some childhood stuff. But one of the odd things in the documentary, she's just like, I didn't like sex, so I just didn't do it. And that's such an, you know, other people in society feel like that today, but she actually just owned it and lived by it. Yet she was still willing to be like, hey, there's people who want to be sexually free and who have these different proclivities that like society doesn't appreciate or understand. And I'm going to try to do something to speak to this. I think people today think of themselves as like activists or bold or whatever. But like putting yourself in that context as who she was, I mean, that was like just a bold, courageous act. And I think speaks more to like her just work in general. That was just an impressive spirit that she brought to her whole lifetime of creation.
Yeah, that's such a good point, because it's not just her art. I mean, her art is very ahead of its time. She truly was the first person to come up with the Infinity Room, for example. But the reason I was like, more people need to know about this woman is because as we started learning more about her, I was like, how can there be someone who like was the first to come up with the Infinity Room concept, who also maybe was the first to preside over a homosexual wedding, who also is one of the top selling artists of all time? I was like, how do I not know of this person who really was, again, ahead of her time, not just in her art, but in thinking about how society can operate, or at least commenting on that? And to that point, she participated in supporting Japan in World War II when she was young, at 13. And I think that seemed to really shape her view of war. And so she was, I think, throughout her later period in the US in the 60s and 70s, was very anti-war. I think she like famously wrote Richard Nixon an open letter offering to have sex with him, even though, as you've said, she doesn't like sex, if he would stop the Vietnam War. And so I think, yeah, just what a fascinating woman. And she very much in her later era in the United States before moving back to Japan was painted as extremely scandalous, which I guess is also an interesting learning, just because it makes sense that if you really are pushing the boundaries, you're going to be seen as scandalous. And she certainly was. And I think that ultimately also was part of what drove her to maybe go even deeper down that mental dark place, because even in the documentary, I think they were saying that like she was not only being painted as scandalous in the United States, but even more so in Japan back home, to the point where people were writing about her in her like family's local town's newspaper, and they would go and they would buy up all the newspapers just so that people wouldn't see what they were saying about their daughter.
It's almost impossible to imagine that happening, like to yourself, and I don't know, just dealing with that. I think as you were speaking, one thing I thought is like something that is just so impressive about her. There's something that like is alluring, is just she's edgy, she's cool, she's innovative, but then she has this complicated history with mental health, but she had this like immense courage the whole way. And it's almost like tapping into the sense that, at least for me, like I'll probably never be like fully who I am, if you will. You know, like we're all on this this journey to like get closer to who we are, to express ourselves in the ways that we want to say what we actually think. And there's some sort of calibration you have. You can't just let the loose thoughts of your mind
but go maybe all you over can.
The Well, you can, but I think there is some like calibration because thoughts are I don't think you'd want like a full download of everyone's thoughts just as unstructured data on the internet. But the point is to go about in your pursuit of creation and to get closer to that truth and that edginess and like that sense of, oh, I can do something that's actually quite different. It's very interesting. Both you and I have done things that are different than the default conventional path. And I think we've talked about those on some of the episodes here, but this is like another level of just becoming it's a different way of it that maybe that's what's impressive is I'm not immersed in the art world. I'm not like a proper artist in that way. And that to me, I just found fascinating.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it does feel like she found a medium in art to express herself, but I do appreciate that that wasn't the extent fully. Like she would lead these nude protests and things like that around war. And to your point, it really is interesting to analyze how she was what sounds like so broken inside, but so strong in a way, like able to stand up for the ideals and concepts that she believed in. But ultimately, it does sound like she was broken by all that happened. And she ended up retreating back to Japan in 1977. And around that time also happened to find a doctor that used art therapy. And I think that ended up helping her to the extent that she's now still in that, I don't know if it's the same mental hospital, but she's chosen to stay in a mental hospital ever since.
Well, what's insane is after she went back to Japan, she kept creating. Like she's been creating this whole time. And I think that's one of the things you found impressive, but me too, just like the level of how prolific she was and is. She just has kept producing for 9 decades. It's just insane.
I just sent you a link in the chat and we'll include it in the show notes, but it's a website called Mutual Art. I don't even know if this encapsulates all her art, and we already know it does not include the 2,000 paintings that she destroyed before moving to the United States. But there's over 8,700 works of art on there from her. And I just think about how in some ways ludicrous that number is. Like 8,700 works of art, some of them are just massive, right? Like she's known, for example, one of her kind of famous art styles are these infinity nets. And you just see some of her infinity nets are just like huge, huge canvases. Like it would take days or if not weeks to create. It's hard for me to truly wrap my head around how she's managed to create so much throughout her lifetime. And then also so many different kinds of art. We've seen the pumpkins, we've seen the infinity rooms, we've seen the infinity nets, which are very different. She's done performative art. It's just, it's kind of wild. Quite frankly,
I think it would be, if I had to guess, like the equivalent of producing something like 200 books during your lifetime, like something that would just be, there's a few people in history who have done it, but it's just like, you have to be alive for long enough and you're just creating the whole time. It's really impressive. I mean, seeing some of the art in the Bilbao Museum, there's one wall that was at least 50 feet wide, 40 feet tall. I mean, it's a big, big piece.
Yeah. And maybe equally important is when she moved back to Japan, the Japanese art community was not very welcoming to her. And she just continued to create, to your point. And then what I found really fascinating about the story is when she was in the US, she did kind of over a long period establish herself, but then she disappeared. Because again, I think the art community, we certainly don't know much about this world, but I think you do depend on people exhibiting your work and other people choosing to feature your work in different museums. And so it seems like she went cold for a while, not in terms of her production, but in terms of her presence in the art community. And then what was so interesting is it did seem like there was just a few art collectors or exhibitors. Again, I don't really know how this world works, who chose to say, you know what, this woman is like amazing. She's created so much. And so there was a few people who seemed to be responsible for bringing her back in a way and giving her the platform. I think one pivotal moment was she was the sole exhibitor for the Japanese Pavilion in the Venice Biennale in 1993, which by the way is the same thing that she created that Narcissus Garden so many years before. Yeah, that was also an interesting I don't know if it's like a revelation for me, but it's like reflecting on history and you're like, wow, if those people didn't exist, what would Yayoi's trajectory be? Would she kind of come back to prominence or would she just fade?
I think this is actually a perfect example of something that you talk about a lot in your kind of like Twitter and stuff like this, but the creator economy today, anyone can just spin up a website, start tweeting, write a book, start distributing on Amazon, whatever you want to do to create online. And you can actually get traction and distribution by just producing good stuff. And there's a lot else that comes with that. It's not just creating good stuff, but learning how to market it and things like this. But the point is the level of gatekeeping is much lower. Now, you can't probably just go and be at the top of the modern art community, even in today's world. But I think what you're speaking to is like a time in which she grew up producing. She spent decades producing without recognition, without fame, without money for her work, or at least a sufficient amount maybe that she was had earned in some sense, until some gatekeepers came in and said, hey, we really like what you're doing. And they distribute it to the world and they give some credibility or stamp of approval. Alternatively, that could have never happened. And I think that's actually one of the things that makes me optimistic about the time we live in today, is that level of gatekeeping, whilst it still exists in some industries more than others, like there is just more equal opportunity in the creative world than there has ever been.
I mean, it is refreshing that she did get the platform that she now has. But I think the thing I love so much about her story is like, I mean, she's not out there being like, I should be getting more royalties or like, you know, I should be known more. She really is just creating art. I bet you today she sat down and she created some art. I bet she walked from her mental health facility to her studio and she created some art. Like that is so cool to me, because not that people's, I guess, intentions need to always be pure, or even, I'm not even saying that her intentions are quote unquote pure, but there's something that's pretty, I guess, just like clean, something beautiful about what she does, which is just, she's dealt with a lot in her life. She even has a quote here that says, I fight pain, anxiety, and fear every day. And the only method I have found that relieved my illness is to keep creating art. And something about that purity comes through in her art. And I think that's why ultimately, despite a lot of ups and downs that happen throughout her 94 years of existence, resonates with people on the other side.
I mean, if we had to distill it down, it's like she does the work and she does it because she has to stay sane. And I mean, that's not easy to replicate. I think it speaks to like how she ended up creating such a unique style. She just followed her inner muse, whether that was driven by like mental health conflict or like a desire to produce. But it's very different than like, hey, I'm going to build some large niche around artificial intelligence because people are talking about that and I can maybe sell this newsletter for $2 million a couple years from now. Those are like really different things. And I think sometimes people confuse the two.
I agree.
I see that you've changed your Zoom background.
I needed more Yayoi in this. I don't even know if she's created all of these. I think so, but got the pumpkin again.
I like the pumpkin and the polka dots. I think the polka dots is if you really want to embrace the Yayoi. That's the vibe.
Are you going to buy me a pumpkin?
I think they sell for $5 to $8 million. So we're really going to have to produce a lot more of this podcast, or I don't know. We're going to have to do something quite different to even begin to think about such a question.
All right. Something that I think might make sense to close off on is just, I still feel like I have no clarity as to why more people don't know about her. Are we just unaware because we don't know much about modern art or art in general, or what's the deal?
I think some piece of it is that you and I are bumpkins and we don't know about things. My guess is, so she's now in the top 10 most selling artists pretty much every year. She just hits the top 10. I think in 2022, close to $200 million of her art was sold at auctions, and some pieces are going for $5 to $10 million. So she's definitely getting more well-known because of that. I mean, money drives everything, right? But I think a piece...
your brain was recognizing that fact as you were saying it and then got a little depressed about it. But anyway.
Yeah, depressing, but it's the truth. So I thought about this a little bit with Yayoi. And so it's unclear because we're not like modern art people or just art people in general. That said, I think there's a couple of things. So one is her art is best experienced in person. So the sculptures are so big, they're so elaborate, there's so much going on that you don't see a lot of replicas in people's houses or around the world. So just as an example, there's this like really famous painting. It's called The Great Wave by Hokusai. And you see this replicated everywhere. Brands are using it like on water bottles. You see in ads, like it is almost just in your unconscious. Now, most people don't know that artist as well, but I think Yayoi has a similar effect where her work is not replicated. And then even if you saw it or you saw derivatives of it, she's somehow not credited with the work in the same way that like Wes Anderson's films are so clearly his. And I think there's a couple other things like in the modern era. So one is like she has an Instagram. She only has 400,000 followers, which seems kind of low for her. And I looked at it and it's just like, this could be better managed. She probably has nothing to do with social media. She's like, not widely.
Probably like, get this out of my face. Exactly. I wonder if this, is this her or is it a fan account? I guess it's her.
I guess it's her, but it's just, it's clear that something like that in terms of distribution could be bigger. And she's like not on the other channels as well. And then I think the last thing is when it comes to something like art, being a person that's out there, being a person that's speaking, being almost like she was in the 1960s and 70s where she was a part of a scene.
Yeah.
Is something that helps with that distribution, but she's in a mental health facility in Japan. And so even though her work is displayed at all the best exhibits around the world, the Tate, the Bilbao, this is actually the SF MoMA is going to have an exhibit starting in a month. So if you're in the Bay Area, you can check that out.
Damn, we're going to that.
Yeah, definitely going to that. I mean, biggest fans ever now, right?
I'm getting a tattoo. Just a bunch of polka dots.
Yeah, I mean, cool. Whatever you want. But all of that sort of combines to her not being as well known. And maybe there's like a gender component to this as well, where for one reason or another, it's just hard to break into the modern art world. Maybe not as much today, but as a female artist and to be as well known as male figures. It's the same in entrepreneurship and pretty much anything. So there's like lots of forces maybe moving against her, despite her work being everywhere and tapping into that universal consciousness that is the infinity of existence.
The infinity of existence. I'm actually on her Instagram page. I'm seeing like George Clooney's on here. She did some partnership with Louis Vuitton. And so I guess she is in the mainstream, but yeah, maybe there's just something around like, people recognize her work, but not her. I wish that wasn't the case because I feel like she is in her work. And I think more so than maybe the average artist.
Yeah. And maybe that's okay. But hopefully this podcast brings a few more thousand people like into the world of Yayoi. If you haven't heard about her, go check her out. I think the best starting place is actually the Amazon Prime video, Kusama Infinity. That alone will just, I think, be a worthwhile use of an hour of your time to just go learn about someone who's pretty interesting.
Oh my gosh, I just saw Justin Timberlake is also on her Instagram. She really is in the zeitgeist, I guess.
Yeah, maybe now that she's selling for so much money, it's like that really is what's driving it. But 20 years ago, I mean, how many people would have known about Yayoi? I'm not sure. I'm sure now there's people trying to bring this awesome story to life.
Yeah.
Especially she's almost 100. That's crazy.
I know. It really is crazy. I mean,
we need to get some longevity advice from her.
Right? Yayoi, we've got a lot to learn from Yayoi. And I think one of the cool things about her Instagram is she posts stuff from her early days. And I think you can just see how long she's been at it for.
I'm just envisioning the midwit meme. There's just make art at both ends. And then there's the longevity bros in the middle being like, cold plunge, get your sunlight, take your pills.
Oh, you're saying like to survive 94 years, just make art.
Yeah. Actually, it's probably just have good genetics. I think the biggest driver of everything. But yeah.
I'm glad we did this. I feel like she is someone who, there's a lot to learn from her in different ways. And maybe we're going to get a bunch of commentary from people to be like, oh, obviously, Yayoi Kusama, she's my fave, been following her for years. But I have a feeling there's going to be quite a few people who actually had no idea who she was, what she's done. And I hope that's changed.
Yeah, it'd be funny if she's actually as well known as like Barack Obama. And everyone's like, oh yeah, you did an episode giving some basic and probably some factually inaccurate information.
No, we tried to check this. I don't know if we got everything right, but
yeah, of course.
All right. If you made it this far, thanks for listening. Yayoi for the win. Yayoi Infinity. We will take donations that will go towards a Yayoi pumpkin if you'd like to contribute.
All right. Until next time.
Thanks for listening.